Hi, I'm Shane Twist and welcome to Behind the Beef, a podcast that gives you a look behind the scenes and into the everyday activities of the people behind the beef. In today's episode of Behind the Beef, we are joined by Jake Phillips. Jake Phillips is the Extension Manager at Angus Australia, based in Narracourt, South Australia. Jake has a wealth of industry experience and knowledge and has worked across Australia in a variety of positions in the beef supply chain over the past two decades. Jake's role is considered frontline with Angus members and breeders of Angus cattle to assist them in understanding the variety of breeding and genetic selection tools and information available to them. This also includes overseeing the expansive Angus Youth Scholarships, Awards and Bursaries offered to industry. In his spare time, Jake and his wife run Phillips Cattle Company, a registered cattle business. Jake has enjoyed the opportunity to judge cattle at major events across Australia, as well as helping younger people enter the cattle industry. Jake has joined us for the podcast to talk about the fact that he recently completed a five-week beef study tour of the United States as the 2023 Arthur Rickard's Young Breed Leaders Award recipient. During this episode, Jake shares about the scholarship experience, his takeaways from his tour, and more. Thanks to Jake for joining us for the podcast. Let's jump into our chat now. Thank you very much, Jake, for joining us for the podcast. Again, we were just discussing how it was a few years ago the last time that you were on the podcast. We were in COVID and it wasn't face-to-face, but you're back. You're in a different role this time than what you were when we spoke previously. And you're also kind of here for a different reason, not so much just talking about Angus Australia. So welcome back to the podcast. Can you just let the audience know who you are and where you're from?
Thanks for having me, Shane. My name's Jake Phillips. Many of our members might know me through my professional career, but if I haven't met you, I'm from Narracourt on the Limestone Coast in South Australia.
Just to start off, what are some of your earliest memories of Angus cattle in your life?
Great question. So probably through high school, I really developed an interest, a passion, my wife would say an obsession for cattle. And that included Angus cattle, Murray Grey cattle and Pole Hereford cattle. And so that was kind of my the spark of interest in Angus cattle, particularly registered Angus cattle, working with a number of the studs, I suppose, through the Adelaide Hills. And that actually led me to end up applying to go to the Angus Roundup at Glen Innes in 2011. And that was really where I kind of discovered the Angus industry and the Angus family, I suppose. And I really remember actually Dr. Peter Parnell, you know, describing to me his experiences with Angus cattle and that he was attracted to the breed by the cattle and stayed because of the people. And that really resonated with me because here we are, you know, nearly 15 years later and I have the same opinion.
I guess in saying that, so what's your ag story like? What's your personal journey been like and how did you come to be where you are today? And then I guess what does your day-to-day look like now as someone who's involved in the industry?
Thanks, Shane. So I'm a first-generation agriculturalist. I suppose I was brought up very regionally, brought up in the country, but lived in the city. We never really had that kind of farm or that piece of dirt that we could call our own. So spent a lot of time in the country on friends and families, kind of cattle properties or just in the country. So I had a really strong interest in agriculture, but never really practiced it on a full-time basis. Through high school, developed this absolute love and passion for beef cattle. Started working in the industry. I've done pretty much nothing else in the last 20 years. Was very fortunate to win a scholarship through the South Australian Junior Heifer Expo, which let me go to North America for 4 months in 2009. And it was there that kind of my life changed. It actually went from an interest, you know, probably showing a few cattle and having a bit of interest, to actually deciding this is what I want to do with the rest of my life, to be honest. And so that led me to study a Bachelor of Ag, and I've worked in the industry for Breed Plan, for Meat and Livestock Australia, overseeing the MSA system, bought cattle for Tees Australia for 5.5 years, and then worked in plant management, QA management, supply chain manager. But I suppose My inner burning desire and passion, other than my family, is breeding cattle. So all along that journey, I've kind of developed a breeding herd and worked for people and pinched and borrowed and not stole, but done everything I possibly could to kind of build myself something, more out of interest than anything. And so, yeah, we breed a few cows now, my wife and I, with our son, Angus, believe it or not. And so it's been quite the journey, I suppose. And I think it's just a great example of the opportunities in agriculture that takes people from any background. And if you turn up with the right work ethic and attitude, people will really open their doors to. And I'm very thankful for the opportunities I've been given to where I'm standing today at 35 years of age. It's been a pretty incredible two decades.
Yeah. I guess plenty of people probably listening may come from a rural background or a background off of living off a place or something like that. And I guess for some of them, maybe when they were younger and they think about back when they were children, they think, oh, that's all I sort of envisioned for myself. So it's very interesting to speak to somebody like you who's come from a background that's not exactly the, I guess, a linear projection to where you are today, but you've still found that love for it. And I guess if you look back as a child, it's probably not what you expected your life to look like.
Not at all. I suppose some of my earliest memories, though, are, you know, sitting on the front of a, you know, two-wheeler bike with a guy called Jock Taylor from Lake Victoria Station in New South Wales while he was rounding up his sheep, and I was only 3 or 4 years of age, you know. So those are early memories of agriculture. But it's a bit like, you know, if your mum or your dad was a carpenter or a welder or something, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be. And I sort of see agriculture a bit the same, where my mum and dad were very aware of it, but they had really no transferable skills or assets for me. But that doesn't actually stop the dream that I've got. And exactly. I see it as a bit of a trade, right? You're always developing your skills and your knowledge and your experience. And so just because you're brought up on a farm doesn't mean that you have to be a farmer. You know, you can go and be a school teacher or a hairdresser or, you know, rocket pilot or whatever, you know. So I think this is a good example of life that you just have to make the most of the opportunity that's in front of you. Land ownership's a different story. That's a real challenge. But you don't actually have to own land to work in agriculture, and that's why I love it.
Yeah. So you've touched on your own business that you've got going now. So what does your business look like, and what's your breeding philosophy or breeding objectives?
Well, good question. I suppose that's an evolving space. For my wife and I, we're busy people. We both are away from home for several parts of the week at times. We travel and our career commitments, I suppose. So what that means for the cattle is they need to be really resilient and do it themselves. So things like calving ease are really important for us. That was kind of one of the traits that we have particularly been sensitive to over the last 15 years. Outside of that, growth is really important to us, particularly for 400-day growth. That for the environment that we run in, we're very orientated towards people producing feeder cattle. And so cattle that can express that, I suppose, ideal 400-day weight's really important to us. Structure as well. We're a self-replacing herd. Some of our clients are self-replacing herds. And so longevity in cattle and cattle that are not going to fall out of the system before they're due to is really important for us. And I think as a first-generation breeder, we've started from scratch. We started with 2 cows. We're now at 23 cows. Every post has had to be a winner. So structure's not just a fad or something that's semi-important to us. We can't have female cattle particularly leaving our herd before we want them to for any reason, because they're so valuable to us. We just don't have many to choose from. The other part too, having a young family, now being a father and also working away from home a bit, docility is really important to us, because we might actually have to be relying on someone that's not as capable with the cattle to be doing work with them in an emergency situation, or we might just be away. And so I want to feel really comfortable that we've got a herd that has an acceptable temperament. So they're kind of the four traits that we would focus on. Our philosophy is really about breeding balanced cattle. They're not extreme in any way, and they're actually really maternally focused, because we've started with what we've started with. It's nowhere near where we want to end up being. And so we need every calf to be better than its mother. That's kind of our philosophy. So that's when we look at potential mating candidates or just what we're doing in our life with this business, every calf's got to be better than its mum, and we just got to keep edging that needle forward in terms of the quality and consistency and what we want to do, and stand behind it. And we're pretty proud of what we've achieved, but I'd only say we're in our infancy and we've got a long way to go.
Yeah. For your herd, what are your target markets? What kind of cattle are you breeding?
So for us, we've started with a commercial herd and we've transitioned to a registered herd. I think being in South Australia where we are, we're probably experiencing more climate variation than perhaps we ever had. And we also have a really strong feeder market, and they're mainly self-replacing herds. So it's very similar to our breeding philosophy, that yearling animal that can be between 360 and 500 kilos. It's a good weight for age to suit the feeder market. That's really the kind of ideal article. And I think the benefit of Angus cattle is if you've got a 400 kilo Angus steer, they just suit nearly every market in Australia. And that's actually really like why we've tried to focus on that as a objective and target market, because it just gives us options, to be honest with you. And we don't turn out a lot of steers or anything like that. But at some stage, people that we would sell a bull to, or potentially us if we can expand further, they're just going to have more markets they're suitable for. And I think those options are really quite a valuable proposition when you're looking to turn off your cattle.
So changing hats probably a little bit here, you've touched obviously on your personal profession and being a cattle producer yourself, but you've also got the hat of being the extension manager at Angus Australia. Can you let us know what that role actually is for people that aren't familiar with the work that you do and what you are trying to achieve with Angus producers through your role?
I just say, Shane, I'm extremely privileged to work for Angus Australia, that's been around for more than 100 years. We've had Angus cattle in Australia for 200 years. In fact, I think it's the 200th anniversary this year.
Yeah.
So it's quite the honour. The extension manager role does three main things. We have a small team, Hunley Jansen in Gundawindi and Nancy Crawshaw in New Haka, New Zealand, and I'm in Narracourt, obviously. So we look after three things. One is education of our producers, mainly around breeding and genetics, won't surprise you, but we are diversifying a bit into other things, such as we're doing our Breadwell Fedwell programs, and sometimes we put out some information around cattle prices or climate drivers and things like that. But effectively, education, workshops, webinars, printed resources, website updates, of which many come across your desk, Shane. The second component is member engagement. And that's kind of passive education where members can come and learn as little or as much as they would like in a setting that might be a feedlot tour or a conference or a processing tour. And so there's no kind of lecture kind of education around it, but it's more passive education around production systems and how you can better your operation. And the third thing is all of our great Angus Youth Scholarships, Awards and Bursaries, which includes Gen Angus, which we're at currently while recording this, and they're industry leading. So lots going on. And so what do we try and do with our members? For me, it's really clear and really simple in my mind. If we can help our members breed better cattle, whatever better means to them, if we can help them get to where they want to get to, hopefully we've done our job. And I do feel that we do that, and it's an evolving space, and I love it. We're very privileged. We get to spend time around the kitchen tables of families in their best times and in their times that aren't as great. We become friends with a lot of these members. And it's one of life's honours to be able to do that sort of role.
Yeah. You also touched on the fact that you guys handle the Angus Youth Program. You actually, it's a bit of a full circle kind of thing for you because you are a previous scholarship recipient through Angus Youth. So do you want to just touch on how that has influenced your life? We will touch on Angus Youth a little bit further down, but how things like that have influenced your, I guess, career progression or your steps through the industry?
I think all breeds youth programs are critical to our industry. The reason I believe that is we've had so much scientific development that in the near future, we're going to have the ability to submit a piece of DNA and we're going to be able to tell you who the sire and who the dam is and its genetic merit score really quickly. But where the difference is going to be in the success of our industry is the quality of people that we have producing the food, providing support, processing, marketing, educating consumers, all of those types of roles. So where the youth program, I think, has its role is about attracting and retaining talent. So I didn't start with Angus.
Yeah, no.
But I was attracted to Angus. Yeah. And I've been retained, I suppose, haven't I? So, mm-hmm. And I think that's the great thing that Angus do. I think all breeds have a great place with their youth programs. I think the difference for Angus is we have a thing called the Angus family. And probably sounds a bit cliche, but there's probably not another group of breeders and members across the world, but particularly Australia and New Zealand, that are so supportive, accommodating, and really focused on supporting that next generation. And that's why I think the Angus Youth Program has been so successful, because it's forward thinking. We provide a huge range of opportunities, perhaps tailored more to that middle age and older young people, of which I'm not sure where I fit in anymore, Shane, but it's a really special place, and we see a lot of talent in our industry come through the Angus Youth Program and end up in extremely prominent positions across beef. So it's good for Angus, but it's also good for the beef industry more broadly.
Yeah. So when you look at both, you know, what you do in your day job, but also doing what your life revolves around in your personal life, being a producer yourself, what's the best part for you about being involved in the agricultural industry?
I think for me, like I said, I didn't come from this background, so the opportunity is really there to be seized, I suppose. That's what I love on face value, that you can make a go of whatever it is. And you could say that about all things in life, but I just love how open and how much opportunity there is there. What's actually really satisfying, though, is producing beef, right? We're producing food here. We're actually producing an article that brings families together where they celebrate, you know, love, sadness, relationships, birthdays, maybe not Christmas or Easter, depending where you are, but so much special occasion is celebrated with beef, and that all starts with someone putting the bull out with the cows. So it's a really special thing to have food that brings people together and they use it as something to celebrate. And I think the other part is that's really challenging at times, it could also kill them, right? It's a food, it's a biological product. So it's such a delicate thing. It's not like making something in manufacturing. We put so much care and love into producing this food. We love our animals, the welfare, the safety of them. And then we need to really be delicate with the product, because it brings people together and we want it to be a memorable experience. So I think in summary, I just take so much pride in that.
Yeah.
That there's not too many things in life that are just cherished of to have such good memories about.
It's a pretty good way of looking at it. You've opened my eyes to a different way of thinking about it. And I've asked that question to quite a few different people. So I always like hearing everybody's different, you know, their view of how being involved in the agriculture industry influences how they feel about it. As somebody who is involved in the Angus breed in particular in a couple of different ways, as someone who produces cattle but also works very closely in the Angus breed with our producers, I guess what's the best part then about being involved with the Angus breed?
I think that we're not pigeonholed into any one thing. I mean, yeah, Angus Australia, through your team, Shane, have that kind of motto and that strategy about there's Angus for every system. And I just think it's so accommodating to everyone from all walks of life. It's actually a breed that's affordable to get into. And then you can be the best possible veal producer, weaner producer, backgrounder, feedlotter, you know, whatever part of the industry you want to be part of, you can do it with Angus cattle. And so I think that that's the most encouraging thing, that we're not just, you know, pigeonholed into being a long-fed, high-marbling breed, not mentioning any names, or, you know, we're not considered terminal. Across the world, we're considered the cornerstone of people turning to for that female reproduction and and really the cornerstone of wherever they want to get to in their breeding career pretty much starts with Angus. And that's pretty exciting to be part of, that it's so inclusive.
Yeah.
Yet you can still specialise in whatever you wanted to really do.
It's good to get some insight into yourself and where your place in the industry. You actually are joining us as well because you've come off of a pretty significant moment in your life and career, in the fact that you've just returned a couple of months ago. I've returned from traveling around America because you were recently awarded the Arthur Rickards Young Breed Leaders Scholarship, which is presented each year by the Australian Registered Cattle Breeders Association, or ARCBAR. So congratulations. I mean, that's a pretty massive achievement, and then going forth into a pretty massive couple of weeks for you. So what originally encouraged you to apply for that award?
If I cast my mind back sort of 15 years ago, I probably had the time and had the interest, and probably because I came from a reasonably naive, you know, first generation position, I did apply for a few scholarships, and I was fortunate enough to get some of those through Angus Australia. But then if I fast forward 15 years, I've really focused on my career, building my cow herd, having a family. And I actually had more questions because I'd sort of focused on getting things done and life and all that sort of stuff. But I felt like I was still missing some pieces about really where I wanted to get to. And when you get to 35, Shane, there's not a lot of youth things that you qualify for. So the Arthur Rickards Young Breed Leaders Award, the ARCBAR Scholarship, I was aware of that. Arthur Rickards actually gave me my first job out of university, and unfortunately he's passed away now. So I was aware of the award, and the criteria I felt that I met in terms of representing the breed well and wanting to find the kind of new breedings and trends and what could you go and learn that could also be applicable to other people. So I applied for it, and it's been one of the highlights of my life to be a finalist and then ultimately be selected to go.
So what was the selection process like for the scholarship?
So written application with your CV, covering letter, also some supporting references as well as to why you would be, why you'd be excellent. And I was very fortunate to have a couple of referees do that for me that are prominent in the industry and that I'd worked with for a long time, and sort of cross your fingers then. But then a couple of interviews, one was online, Shane, and one was in person. And I think the great thing about the interviews is on the interview panel we had, you know, directors and prominent breeders from the Murray Grey Society and the Belmont Society and the Charolais Society and an independent chair and the Angus Society for other people. Of course, I didn't have that working for Angus Australia. But so really what they're looking for, to be honest, is representatives of the beef industry and no one that's sort of too beef breed centric. It's got to be good for everyone. And perhaps coming from an unbiased point of view, and obviously very Angus now, but I can appreciate the benefit across all breeds, not just for one particular breed.
Just a bit off topic, but I guess for a pretty extensive selection process like that, I imagine there'd be some people that are looking to apply for scholarships like that and are put off by that kind of pressure of a selection process like that, with the potential that they don't get selected for the scholarship. I guess it's maybe difficult in hindsight, looking back, since that you were selected for the scholarship, but I guess what's your advice for people having gone through that, and what benefits do you think that you got even just from going through a pretty rigorous selection process like that?
I think the questions that you have to address in your covering letter, and then if you're successful to get to the interview, are actually just really good questions to have a position on for yourself in the industry. So I think having questions about, like, you know, what value could you contribute back to the beef breeding industry? What challenges do you see in the beef industry? If you could change one thing, what would it be in the beef industry? They're really actually important questions. So discussing them with your family, your mentors, you know, your boss, your wife, whatever it might be, are actually really good discussions to have. Like, what is the biggest challenge in the beef industry? And if you could change one thing, what would it be? And why do you think you're actually suitable for that position? So I think you learn so much out of the application and the interview process, regardless of if you ever received the award, the process is actually really educational for your own kind of personal development. Yeah.
Can you please give us an overview of your trip to America? So what you did and where you went?
So the question that I posed was, is it possible for a first-generation producer or first-generation person to create a seed stock business for their incoming children, perhaps, that would be able to stand up on its own two legs, for example? Because that is my position. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to know, is that possible? Because there's so many reasons you could say it's not possible. So with that in mind, we went to the US for 37 nights. When I say we, my wife and my son Angus came with me, my wife Emma, and that was an absolute pleasure to do it as a family, as a team. And we travelled through 13 different states, took 11 different flights. We stayed with families across the Midwest, the North, and we went to conferences and cattle shows and breed societies, and it was multi-breed. It obviously had an Angus strong component, but we spoke to and stayed with leading Charolais breeders, the Simmental Association, IGS, spent great time with the American Hereford CEO. So it was a really eye-opening experience. And what we were doing really is asking people, what mistakes have they made in their life? If they had their time again, what would they do differently? You know, if they were going to start from scratch, what advice would they give to other people? And trying to really short circuit this journey that we're on to try and glean as much information, experience from people that have walked the walk, maybe not on exactly the same path, but they would have lessons and mistakes that they had made that maybe it might stop us making similar ones. Mm-hmm. And so there's a range of like things that we would look at, that, you know, what we would do with our own herd, but also our careers. And, you know, it was just a really intense experience. And there's so many take homes for each place. You know, we went to leading Angus ranches, we went to bull sales, went to two universities, and you know, happy to talk about that chronologically if you would like. But really all of the take homes came down to three main things, and that was what we refer to as cows, culture and character. And all of the kind of breeders, I suppose, that we look up to and aspire and think that they are really in the prime of their business, they had the cows right. And what that means is they had a direction, mm-hmm. they had a consistent herd, they had an awareness of the cows for their environment, and they had a very detailed and dedicated breeding program. Culture, they were practicing integrity, resilience, humility on a daily basis, even when no one was watching.
Yeah.
And you could really nearly kind of guess what the cows were going to be like by how the breeders demonstrated their culture.
Yeah.
And that was a really nice thing. And then the character part, I'm not sure if we can swear on this podcast, Shane, but sometimes SHIT happens.
Yeah.
And how do you respond to that? You know, when you're on your last dollar, you've had a tragedy, a train wreck, a real issue. How do you get back to being normal again and get the show back on the road?
Yeah.
And I think all of the breeders that we really aspired to, and some of them are good friends now, they had those three things in bucket loads.
Yeah.
And I think what we learned out of the trip is we could actually start practicing all three of those things straight away, and we don't need a big farm to do that.
Yeah.
So that was actually one of the take homes, is let's get our cows right. Let's really focus on that. Let's continue and improve our culture. Mm-hmm. And let's also just make sure that we've got enough resilience, and when things perhaps are tough, it's not forever.
Yeah.
And how are we going to get back on the road? And that was a huge lesson across so many different people and walks of life, and people in all sorts of different circumstances. You know, two first generational breeders we spent time with started with just a few cows.
Yeah.
You know, one, Kevin Yon, he's been on the American Angus board before, started with 100 cows. Now they've got 1,400 cows and market 450 bulls a year. And they have three children that are back in the family business, and they started with 100 cows.
Yeah.
Aaron and Shana Strumman Ranch in St. Anthony, North Dakota. started with 6 cows. Now they've got 350 cows, you know, on property bull sale, market 150 bulls a year, female sales, through to, you know, Hoover Angus, who they've been in, they've had a sale now for, I think it's 98 years. Mm-hmm. Land is multi-generational. And, you know, through to Brent Thiel at LT Ranch, or Thiel Ranch now, you know, renowned as being the most progressive Charolais breeder in the world, and, yep, and has probably created the mecca for Angus cattle in North America now too. So just huge variation, but they had those three things in common.
And always something to learn.
Absolutely.
You touched on some of the other experiences that you had in terms of attending stock shows and stuff. So is there any other highlights of places that you went? You touched on the fact that you have a bit of a chronological order, but is there any ones that really stood out for you over the course of the five, it was 5 weeks or 6 weeks?
It was 5 weeks, 37 nights. Yep. Yeah. So started at Denver National Western Stock Show. And that's just it has been traditionally, perhaps challenged now, but one of the leading stock shows in the world. Amazing to see that operation. If anyone gets to go to the US, perhaps consider starting there. Starts in the first week of January, so it's a nice time to go. Universities, Kansas State University and University of Illinois, spent time there. That was great to see the educational system and the opportunities for students in the US, where, you know, they get to put on their own bull sale with the university's own herd, and they study it as a class, and they have calving barns where the students study carving, and they have to work in the carving barns, and, you know, campus bull collection centres, and so many interesting, great practical skills that in Australia we just probably haven't gone that way. We're perhaps a little bit more academic in our style, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that was a good observation. 3.5 days with American Angus. I mean, Mark McCulley's crew are world leaders. It makes perfect sense why Angus Australia collaborate with them so much. CattleCon, the NCBA Cattle Convention, which was in Orlando in Florida. Amazing. 3,500 people. You know, this is an indoor facility where they had two guys on horseback showing how to put green cattle through a bud box for the first time, and how it should be done to improve welfare and safety for everyone. And and then next door you've got a, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean bar, and then vaccination.
It's so Florida.
Vaccination demonstrations and people selling drench. And then, you know, you've got a conference with this 1,500 producers hearing about the market update from Cattle Facts and what the climate for the next 12 months is going to be. Like, it just blows your mind how much opportunity there is to learn. So they're probably some of the highlights. I mean, some of the other breed societies, I suppose, I spoke about were also highlights as well. There's sort of too many to really narrow it down, I suppose, but they're the big ones. I mean, the breeders we spent time with are an absolute treat and a highlight, but I think some of the events are important too.
Yeah. What are some things that, I guess, surprised you about the trip and some of the areas of the ag industry that you visited over there?
It's a good question. I suppose I have been to the US before, and so some of the stark differences in the industry I was probably aware of, like their grain feeding system, their availability to low-cost, high-energy feeds like corn. You know, they turn off cattle generally at lighter weights. They feed them for longer, and they confine, in some areas, confine cattle for quite a long time over winter, feeding them, and then let the grass get away in spring and summer to let the cows go to grass. And there's some really stark differences to Australia, I suppose. I think probably one of my learnings this year was, or from this scholarship, was how in tune a lot of the US is with cow-calf production. And I think it's because they are in such close confinement and proximity for a good part of the year because of the weather. They have to really be across animal health, because they're in such close contact with these beef animals. And if you compare it to, say, dairy, you know, where they see these cows every day, it's a bit like that in North America when it snows. You have to go and break the ice on the trough every morning, or they won't have water, and you've got to go and feed them. And so I'm not saying the cattle are better, but I thought that in things like animal health and nutrition, particularly, the US really had some quite leading examples of innovation.
Yeah.
If I then flip it, though, say to Australia, I thought, yeah, our animal welfare awareness, our traceability for sure, and even our awareness of genetics is probably superior because we really rely on those things because we have an extensive production system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I suppose, like some general kind of differences. I mean, the other part that's, I mean, obvious is cattle basically run, you can farm most parts of the US.
Yeah.
Some of them are far more difficult for, you know, tropical reasons around tick and fly and heat and all that sort of stuff, through to blizzards and snow.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to deal with quite the extremes in Australia, but we have a lot of Australia that's not really that arable. Let's just be honest. So it's quite, I suppose, different, where it's a very similar land mass. They probably have less distance to the closest abattoir, the closest airport.
Yeah.
It might only be 2 or 3 hours, for instance, the closest feedlot.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia, a lot of our parts, you know, we've got even some members here at Jen Angus, they're 1,000 kilometres away from the nearest airport, and they're probably closer to 2,000 kilometres away from the nearest abattoir. So different challenges, I suppose, very different production systems.
Yeah. Were there any profound outcomes from the trip that you didn't anticipate?
That's a really good question. Probably the thing, given the question that we were trying to ask, is I think that the US are culturally far more advanced in having partnerships in farming. And I know, say, in Australia with dairy and cropping, we do share farming and partnerships quite well. Beef cattle, not as much. And so in the US, a number of the people that we visited have at some stage and might even continue to have a partnership with that seed stock operation. And that might be where someone owns the land and someone owns the cattle. They might have 50-50. They might have employees that have some equity in the business. And even on the commercial side, there's, you know, family cow-calf producers that still then own those feeder cattle in the feedlot. So they're actually paying someone to feed them, and they'll own them all the way through to slaughter. So I think that integration that the US has is quite admirable. I think sometimes in Australia we can perhaps stick to our own fence line, our own box, and we do a really good job for us.
Yeah.
But there could be other people in the industry where there could actually be a win-win if we just, you know, collaborate a bit and work together. So I think that's a cultural difference that we probably, I'm not sure if it's profound, but that was a really clear difference in how a lot of the North Americans were thinking about farming and agriculture and how they could actually get to where they want to get to.
Yeah.
An example of that, you know, Alex Brookhauser at T-Bone Angus had multiple leases for when corn's harvested. They have corn stocks, which is similar to stubble here in Australia. And he might lease them for just 3 or 4 months. And he has this wagon set up with a crush and yards, and he'll take the cattle and go and calve on all these corn stocks.
Yeah, right.
And in Australia, you know, maybe in sheep, the industry, you might go and, you know, put some lambs or something next door on the stubble or whatever, but you don't actually kind of create this business out of share farming the same land for just a period of time. So I think there's all those sort of like simple things on a general scale that we really looked up to, and I think that's a cultural difference for sure.
Were there any parts of the experience that really tested your theories and opinions or opinions about producing beef cattle, or any in turn that really resonated with you?
One of the examples, I suppose, at CattleCon, and it's a really political, topical debate, sometimes heated in the US still, is around traceability. So in Australia, we're lucky we've had the NLIS system. It's not foolproof, but it's very, very good for the last 25 years. The US does not have a national-based traceability system.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're really battling with that at this stage, and there's all these benefits around, you know, disease outbreak, tools that NLIS tags would provide us, insights into benchmarking, cattle performance, all that sort of stuff that the US is actually missing out on, and they can't decide whether they want to have it mandatory, voluntary, or nothing at all. So that was a pretty big, I suppose, awakening of how lucky we are here in Australia to have systems like that.
Yeah.
I think the other part, which I sort of spoke about before, is that because we're generally quite extensive here in Australia, we probably do see a lot more genetic variation because, you know, we have large pastoral type areas, and so these cattle are often given a very similar opportunity, and some of the environments we put these cattle in are marginal. And so the genetics really need to flourish. And if you think about that US system about, you know, really a lot more feeding, more than 90% of the cattle in the US are grain fed. I think it's something like 97%. They're really providing an environment to hit their specifications quite well. And so even though there's genetic differences, they're still meeting the minimum requirement through feeding. So I think I was quite proud of the cattle we have here in Australia, particularly Angus cattle, that I do feel for a number of traits, they're genetically well adapted, some traits that are perhaps superior. And we've done a good job of describing those traits too and letting breeders get on with breeding the type of cattle that they want to. And the traceability system helps them do that, because we then get carcass feedback and animal health feedback back in, and the whole sort of wheel just keeps spinning with more information, more outcomes, more tools. I felt the US perhaps might be ahead on some practical management type things, but Australia really should be proud of those systems.
Yeah. So now you're home. I guess when you look back at the experience now and you've had some time to digest what you learned, how are you actually going to be able to apply what you learned overseas to your life in Australia, and how is it applicable to yourself, but then I guess also your influence on the beef industry or the beef industry in Australia?
It's a good question. Multiple facets there, Shane.
Yep.
I did say you can ask me hard questions and you haven't missed. So, look, I just want to be clear. There's a couple of things here. I have the best job in Australia working for Angus Australia in this role. It actually probably made me realise that that's the case, because I'm so fortunate to basically wake up every day and do something that I love. So that was actually an outcome to go, geez, of all the jobs in the world, you actually got a really good one. I'll come back to what that actually means for our members in a moment. On a personal level, I think we've now got some strategy where we left thinking, oh, do we need to lease another farm or try and buy a farm? It's just impossible. Interest rates, deposit, you know, it's just so prohibitive. There's actually lots of things we can do right now. So get our cows better, form partnerships with other people, invest in the right type of cattle, have the right culture. Think about the revenue, like what are you actually going to do with these cattle? Are they relevant? Will people want them? What can you actually, where are they going to go? Like all of these questions that we've seen, great examples of the US where they're very in tune with that kind of stuff. So, you know, I wouldn't put the targets out here in this podcast, but we've got written things that my wife and I are still, you know, working through, but they're actually now, it's not just a dream, it's actually goals. It's written, it's real. We've got a target. We've probably got steps 3 to 20 identified. Steps 1 and 2 are still working on that. And what does it mean for members? Like, what's the benefit is I just want to help as many people realize their agricultural, but particularly beef cattle dreams as possible, particularly for those people that don't think it is, because let me tell you, it is possible. You can be born in the city, you can develop the right attitude and a bit of work ethic, and you can achieve it. And that's what I really want to encourage people to do and help them on their journey. Mm-hmm. I get to do that through the Angus Youth Program, but I just think, to be honest, I owe so much to the beef industry for the opportunity it's given me and my family, that if I can pay it forward with a bit of interest, that's what I'll do. And, you know, we're over here in All Blacks country at the moment, and one of my sayings that I've had really close to my heart for the last 8 years is about leaving the jersey in a better place. And that's not the jersey cow, that's kind of the jersey you'd play in. And it's not about leaving something that's perfect, Shane. It's actually just about, from where you've started to where you've finished in your life, your career, whatever it is, are you actually going to leave it in a better place? And, you know, I just did the presentation here at Gen Angus on breeding and genetics, and the last slide I put up was a photo of my son, Angus. And I think the challenge for everyone is, will you be able to look your kids in the eye and say, I've done everything I possibly could in my life for you to have a better life than I had?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge. And it's not that I have a bad life. I just want my son to have a really great life. And I think that's kind of the challenge now.
Yeah. Looking back on the experience and then the journey now that you've got going forward, Why would you encourage others to apply for or take experiences like the Arthur Rickard Scholarship or ones that are available through Angus Youth, ones like you've done before, like the Trans-Tasman Exchange, for example? Why would you encourage people to apply or take on those experiences if they become an opportunity for them?
Do you know what they are, Shane? They're catalysts. That's what they are. An example of that is this scholarship was worth $10,000, which is not insignificant. So thank you, Akbar. The trip cost my wife and I, and arguably we had my wife and son along for the journey. The 5 weeks cost us $40,000. So where the catalyst was is that it was actually it's a far smaller part of the overall cost of going. We wouldn't have gone unless I won the scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. So it's actually the catalyst to go and do it anyway. And if you think about some of these other youth opportunities and scholarships, they might provide some funding for you to go and do it, or they might provide an opportunity. But the point is, the opportunity will take you from not doing it to doing it.
Yeah.
And that's what a catalyst is. And this scholarship has changed my life, and it wouldn't have happened unless I won it. And it doesn't matter how significant or insignificant the scholarship or prize or whatever you're applying for is, you just don't know how it would impact you.
Yeah. So looking back on your career, what is the biggest challenge or mistake that you've faced in your career or your life, and how did you overcome it and learn from it?
Oh, well, I make mistakes every day. The biggest mistake probably is I think sometimes, Shane, we can get busy doing the popular things or the big things when really what we should be doing is the important things. And I think that's probably the biggest learning that I've had is that throughout my career I've often thought, oh, we need to be doing this big massive thing and I need to be going for this great job or promotion, or we really need a big farm, or we need to be just going gung-ho. Some of the actually more important things that you'll do might be really small. They might be having that conversation with that person that's struggling, that's down on their luck. It might be asking the right question from mentors or those around you. It might be just doing what's right, even though it's really hard to do. And some of those things are about saying no. No, sorry, I can't do it, because I want to spend time with my son, or I'm going to do this or whatever. So it's a long way to say it, but I think that's probably the thing that I've really come back to is do the important things first. Mm-hmm. Make sure you include a bit of joy in your life, because like once you finish working, life will go on.
Yeah.
So make sure you put a bit of joy in there. And the big things and the popular things, they'll happen anyway. So just don't miss the important things.
Very good advice. What's some of the best advice you've ever been given towards your career?
Towards my career?
Oh, in regards to your career, I guess.
In regards to my career. It's interesting. Look, I've had lots of really great advice working for a lot of really good mentors. But, I mean, I'll just tell you some advice that the current CEO, Scott Wright, you know, has encouraged me to do. And that's try and transition with some of the things you do from being the captain to coach. Mm-hmm. And meaning once you've proven that you can do something in life, in your career, find someone else and help them do it. And I think it's about that analogy. I think it's an old Indian analogy or something, but it's about teaching people to fish. You know, like if you give a man a fish, he'll eat today, and if you teach him to fish, you know, he'll eat forever. And I think that's one thing I definitely didn't naturally start out that way, Shane, but I'm trying to probably really take that advice on. And this is the path, you know, we're talking about the path that I've walked here, but now it's about finding that next person that I can help them walk their path. I think that's what's really important to me. And the other part that, I just have to plug my wife here, actively listen. Listen to understand. And I have not been always good at that. I'm really trying to do that now, because if you just listen to hear, you will miss those important things. So listen to understand.
it's casting your mind back to where you started to where you are today. Do you have any advice for someone who may be pursuing a career in agriculture, I guess even similar background to where you started? Is there any advice that you could give them about, you know, what the rest of their life could look like?
Maybe I'll just treat that as, you know, we get some scholarship applicants or job applicants from time to time, Shane, and I think agriculture is in a really good position at the moment. We have a high number of interest from people from either ag backgrounds or not, and there's lots of different jobs from IT to driving trucks to mating cows to working animal health, all that sort of stuff. I think sometimes with young people we can see they might go and study and they really want to go and be something, be a vet, be a wherever it might be, or applying for a scholarship. Go and get some mud on your boots. Get some crap underneath your fingernails. Go and work for someone that has some cattle. Go and understand physically what reproduction looks like in a cow herd, whether that be calving, mating, whatever it is. Go and help drove some cattle. Work at a feedlot. Demonstrate your passion. Don't just say that, oh, I want to be in the beef industry and this is my dream, and go and actually do it, because I think those intangible kind of unmeasurable skills about being around livestock and that innate, you know, cowgirl, cowboy logic around how animals think and behave and what a healthy one looks like, as opposed to diagnosing it with something that it's bad, that's going to be really important for us. And I see that people that have a really successful career have often started at really, really humble beginnings where they've, you know, started in the most basic position and they've actually worked their way up into management or wherever they want to get to, because they understand every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my advice.
I was thinking when you were saying it, I also think there's a lot to be said about working underneath other people and learning from them, but also gaining a bit of perspective as well about how other people run things. I think there's a lot to be learned from other people throughout the industry. So I like that advice from you. When you look at your life, is there someone who's been, I guess, your biggest supporter or mentor over the course of your career in life?
For sure. I mean, Emma, my wife, has been my biggest supporter. It's extremely hard to be married to me. I live away from home a lot. I have wild ideas, dreams, big dreams. We tend to be busy and do a lot, and Emma supports me with that. So I would just say, yeah, not that I'm full of advice, but something that has really been great for me is find yourself a wolf pack. Like, you can't do it on your own. You cannot do it on your own. Find yourself, doesn't have to be a partner, a family, a friend. Get people around you that are in your corner. I'm very lucky I've got one. I don't probably have one mentor. I mean, I've got people that have really supported me, like Darren Koopman, a breeder in South Australia, you know, Lockie Day and lots of other people. But my family, my mum driving me to cattle shows, you know, before I could drive, and just in my corner every single step of the way when she didn't have to be.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty important. You know, my father-in-law. I think probably where I've sat on mentors, because mentors are such a, like, popular and in vogue sort of
buzzword
in the industry. I think we need to be careful that we don't put in younger people's heads that you need a mentor and who are you going to look up to? Because to be honest with you, I have now kind of got comfortable with looking at different parts of people, their personalities and how they go about life and what they do for a job and that sort of stuff, and taking little bits of everything out of them and using that as a mentor. So it might not be the whole picture that person mentors me on. It might be how they conduct themselves in difficult situations. Mm-hmm. It might be how they breed cows. It might be their resilience when they have a really bad something happens in their life and how they deal with it. You know, within our business, you know, there's lots of people in Angus Australia I consider mentors, you know, to be honest with you. Nancy Crawshaw, Scott Wright, Christian Duff, Dinah. You, Shane, yeah, I don't want to name them all, but they've had different impacts on my life, I suppose. But I think getting those people in your corner is really, really important that will back you in, because you will have challenges. This is not for the faint-hearted, this life in agriculture, whether you own the farm or not. There are difficulties that we deal with in this industry that in other walks of life perhaps aren't as confrontational.
Yeah.
And so you need that support around you.
Yeah. Different seasons of life too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that's probably some advice, you know, as well for people sitting there about to perhaps enter the working industry or whatever. Who are you going to bring with you? You know, like there's a saying about, you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey. Well, I'll tell you what, it's neither of those. It's actually who you do it with.
Yeah. What motivates you to get up in the morning and go to work?
It's easy. It's actually difficult to talk about, but it's my son. Because, again, everything that I do and my wife does is for my son. And it seems funny because we're on these, you know, high-paced careers and we've got our own dreams and stuff like that. But it's all to set him up so he can go to a good school and live a healthy life and hopefully choose a career in agriculture. And he will be surrounded by cattle and cattle people, which are the best kind of people, mm-hmm. Don't we all agree? That's what it's about. It's leaving the Jersey in a better place, leaving a legacy. And our legacy, we feel the things that we're doing now are going to benefit him. We perhaps won't reap the benefits from them ourselves.
Yeah.
But that's what it's about. That gets me out of bed. And to be honest with you, some of the people we get to deal with, like at Jen Angus or whatever, I consider them like my sons too, or, you know, daughters. It's a weird analogy, but I really want to see them succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel that this is such a great industry, great people. If I can play a extremely small part in that journey at some stage, perhaps they will do that for my son.
Yeah.
That's what gets me out of bed.
When you look at the industry, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges our industry will face in the next 5 years?
Yeah, great question. One thing I'm really blown away with, makes me anxious a bit, it's also exciting, is the pace of which we need to know information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a think about the evolution of social media through to getting carcass feedback on cattle that you've killed and making decisions and automation in the paddock, and I think that's one of the real challenges that we've developed a here and now need to know attitude.
Yeah.
And how that applies to breeding cattle is, in Australia, we've got a generation interval of 5 years on our cattle, right? It's a really patient game, which does not suit me at all. But I just will be very interested how those two things will collide, where we want to have more information about the genetic merit, or we want to have more information about bull sale results and whatever form it is. We want to know, you know, paddock yields and all this sorts of stuff. We're dealing with an animal that takes a fairly long time to replace herself.
Yeah.
And some of those things that make a good cow about how she mothers a calf, you know, how maternal she is, you know, when it's a really hot day and that calf's born, does she go and stand on the sunny side and give that calf shade, or it's a you know, white out with hail and she's just calved, does she get on the upwind side? We don't have an EBV for that.
Yeah.
So let's just be really mindful to use the information as well as we possibly can,
mm-hmm.
but to acknowledge we're working with an animal that there's a fair bit of unknown here.
Yeah. Specifically, what do you think will be Angus producers and the cattle industry's biggest opportunities then in the coming years?
I think for the cattle industry, what we've seen like through COVID across the whole world, if beef demand is actually like up at the moment, there's a lot of positivity about the quality of beef, the health benefits. We're now also, well, spreading the word, we already knew this, but also the benefits, particularly of pastoral type operations with, you know, carbon sequestration and we're getting some data around methane emissions. And I think potentially we're actually going to have a really healthy green product in that grass-fed type situation that is actually going to be good at nourishing people.
Yep.
We have a lot of people around the world that are nutritionally deficient. So we've got a high density protein. I think it's actually the highest density protein of any of the meats. And so that's going to be a really great place to play. We've actually got a world health safety food goal here and opportunity. Where the opportunity comes for Angus producers more specifically is, apart from perhaps the very northern echelon of, you know, northern Australia, Angus cattle can be dominant in every other part of our country, in any market. There's no other breed where that is the case. And I'm probably preaching to the converted here and who I work for, but the evidence is there. You can be in central Australia or southern Tasmania. You can be in central Queensland. You can even be right up the Cape York. And Angus genetics have a place to play, particularly around increasing fertility, so getting more calves, and then getting cattle that will fit the market specifications more consistently and to a higher degree than other choices. So we're at the cornerstone of this whole world demand, regardless of where you are.
On that note, that brings us to the end of our questions today. Thank you very much for sharing so much insight into particularly your time over in America, but just in general about how you came to be where you are today and then the work that you're doing both personally and in your Angus professional life. To wrap up, are there any recommendations of a person, program or piece of literature in the industry or outside that you think the listeners should look out for?
It's a good question. I don't really read a lot of books, to be honest with you. But I think one book that has resonated with me for a long time is actually a sporting book called Legacy. And it's funny, we've got all of the Gen Angus participants, you know, here reading that. The reason I like the book, it's by James Kerr. Look it up. It's also available as an ebook. Is it talks about the 15 lessons to why the All Blacks have maintained a roughly 86% winning streak over an enormous period of time, making them the most successful sporting team in the world. From a population, I'm not sure what New Zealand's got, is it something like 6 million people? So really small population, most successful sporting team in the world. How? Like, how does that actually happen? And so these really important cultural steps that the All Blacks take that bring in the Māori and native and traditional New Zealand culture, the modern culture and the sporting mana, they call it, into it. And so I really resonated with that. You've heard me talk about Leave the Jersey in a Better Place. That's actually one of the outcomes of the book. And it's just so fitting for me because nothing's going to be perfect and nothing is forever. But if you actually just leave it better than where you found it, then that's, you know, a great thing. So it's about lessons from the All Blacks that we can put into business. But I just think it's good for life to be honest with you. So if I was going to make one recommendation, go and read the book. I think you'll enjoy it.
Most important question, how do you have your steak?
Well, I personally like a porterhouse steak, normally from South Australia because we have the best steak and wine in the world. Medium rare, pepper gravy on the side, chips and salad. I reckon that's just, you can't beat that.
Yeah. Sounds like a pretty good meal.
It's pretty good. Come down, Shane, and best beef and wine in the world, mate.
So. I'm a Queenslander, so not sure about beef, but I wouldn't mind to go down and have a wine down there. That sounds pretty good about now. Considering that you do have a role with Angus producers around Australia, if they have any inquiries regarding any of the services provided by Angus Australia, how do they get in contact with yourself?
Yeah, so what we would encourage is to call Angus Australia just through the office number, initially, and that's because we have a really great member services team that can, I suppose, filter the inquiries to get to the best possible place. But if your inquiry really is around some of the breeding or genetics kind of decision-making tools, commercial tools like Heifer Select or EBVs, genomics, DNA, you know, more in that, why am I using this and how do I understand it? Please call either Nancy Hunley or myself. Our numbers are available on the Angus Australia website. We kind of have zones or states that we try and more affiliate with, but our only role is to help you as members. Please contact us because that's what we're there for.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jake, for joining us today.
Thanks, Shane, and well done to you on running Australia's Best Angus podcast.
Cheers. Thanks, Jake.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thanks again to Jake for joining us for this episode of Behind the Beef. As Angus Australia surpasses 350,000 genotypes in the taste analysis each fortnight, with continued rapid growth, we have been able to work with our collaborating partners to provide the most up-to-date information for those considering how the technology might apply to them and their breeding programs. We are pleased to bolster our industry-leading Angus Education Centre with a new education module that explains the what, how, why, and when of genomics technology. The Genomics What, How, Why, and When Education Centre module helps breeders and service providers understand how the technology works and how it assists Angus breeders to have the very best information available when making breeding decisions using TACE EBVs. You can access this Education Centre module via the burger menu on the left-hand side of the Angus Australia website homepage. For further information and support regarding genomic technologies, please contact Angus Australia Extension staff on 02 6773 4600. And that's all we have time for. As always, make sure you follow and subscribe to Behind the Beef and leave a 5-star rating or review. And like and follow Angus Australia and Angus Youth Australia on Facebook, X, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Thanks again, and we'll catch you on the next one.